As we are thinking about this year's symposium, we are looking at the need for, let's look at the hydrology portion of it. And so that's why we're talking about weather forecasting. We started out with Tim Schneider trying to give us a national perspective, and then we're trying to then bring it down to the various, if you will, locally. And there's some, Rob deals with the California-Nevada River Forecast Center, so he does California-Nevada. And then we have some folks down at the Center for Western Weather and Water Extremes, which are focusing just on California. And it's been very exciting that that this work is underway, and so we have Andrew Martin, who's going to give us some insights to what they've been exploring down at Scripps.
All right, thanks, Gary. So I'm Andrew Martin. I'm a project scientist at the Center for Western Weather and Water Extremes, or CW3E. I've got the honor of being the first speaker to say CW3E and atmospheric rivers. So hopefully I introduce both of those so that they really stick in your mind, especially for later talks like my boss Marty's going to give on an application of some of the research I'm going to talk about today. So really, this talk is going to be more or less an overview of some of the things that we're doing at CW3E to sort of use scientific research to drive better predictions of precipitations, really in California. You'll notice some of the words on the slide say West Coast. We're starting with a focus really in California and Northern California, which is where most of this talk is centered. But we do have sort of the goal of becoming a more regional center and applying some of these scientific research themes to the Western United States generally. This is an aside that's not necessarily in the talk, but we have found that the atmospheric river concept is important not only just here in California, but also to the West at large. So I'll start with that, and I guess I'll start right off with atmospheric rivers. We'll talk a little bit about AR, atmospheric rivers. It's a shorthand acronym. We say AR. You'll hear that a lot. How they really drive both extreme precipitation and water resources in the West. And then we'll talk about our effort at CW3E to develop a numerical weather prediction system. So again, a meteorology acronym, NWP, is here on the slide, tailored to precipitation in California. We call that system West Wharf. And we'll go over a short scientific result, which is really designed to tell you how we're aiming to have West Wharf tailored to precipitation here in the state of California. And then we'll go on to some more meteorology 101. So I heard somebody talk about Tim gave you guys a three-credit course on numerical weather prediction earlier, modeling at the national level. That'll be a little bit more of the same, but we'll switch focuses, and we'll pretend we're in meteorology class at the end of the talk. So first of all, atmospheric rivers. This is more or less boilerplate material by this point, but it's important to tell you what atmospheric river is, especially since, like I said, I'm the first speaker to bring it up. An atmospheric river is fundamentally a region of strong horizontal water vapor transport. So horizontal is not, the word is not in the slide there, but remember this is water vapor transport from one place on the surface of the earth to another place on the surface of the earth. We measure the transport that takes place in an atmospheric river in a vertically integrated sense. We know that they can carry as much water as 7 to 15 Mississippi rivers. I think that's a bit of an old figure, actually, and we've seen some cases in which it's quite a bit more than that. And they exist primarily, or at least most of the water vapor transport that takes place in an atmospheric river is in the lower atmosphere, so mostly below 2 to 3 kilometers or so. In terms of orienting yourself to meteorology discussion, they're located between warm fronts and cold fronts, typically, and they also have typical length scales. So that's listed in the next bullet point. They're also very common all over the globe. At any given point, there are several atmospheric rivers active in the global circulation. But we know that the Pacific Ocean, and especially the Northern Pacific Ocean in the wintertime, is one place where they're one place and one time in which they're particularly active. So why are these phenomena actually important? Why do we care about them, for example, here in California? Well, The first reason is for water supply. So ARs provide beneficial rain and snow, especially in the wintertime, for water supply. So a study by one of our close colleagues, Mike Dettinger, who was formerly at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, found that in some cases, anywhere from a quarter to, well, generally a quarter to a half, but in some cases nearing a half of annual precipitation in the West Coast states fell in association with atmospheric rivers, so on days in which an atmospheric river was detected. So that's the water supply side, but we also know that if an atmospheric river is particularly strong or stays over one area for a long time, it can cause flooding. And one area in which this is particularly striking is the Russian River area, and so there's a picture here on the slide from, I believe, the town of Guerneville during one flood caused by an atmospheric river in 2004. So the takeaway is that ARs are important both for water supply and for flooding concerns. So we've spun up a few different ways to look at what atmospheric rivers and their both beneficial and hazardous impacts. One of those that I'm going to talk about right now is a model that we're calling West Wharf at CW3E. So West Wharf is what's called a regional numerical weather prediction model. We heard earlier about the plans for GFS, which is a global NWP model. And so West Wharf is focused more on a smaller region of the Earth and can, in most cases, be run at higher resolution than the global numerical weather prediction models. It's based on an open source code base, which is called WRF-ARW, which is actually produced or is housed, so to speak, at NCAR. And we've taken that code base and done some work to optimize it for atmospheric rivers, and especially atmospheric rivers in Northern California. So you see on the left there, there's an example of a forecast visualization that comes from West Wharf. This visualization is for a moderate to strong atmospheric river that impacted Northern and Central California back in March of this year. And the field being displayed there is integrated vapor transport, so one of the common indicators for where an atmospheric river is and how strong it is. So you could have found an example of this particular figure in that exact form on the CW3E website this last year while we were running forecasts in real time. There's an example of some of the people that are working on West Wharf up there on the slide, and I'd like to take a little bit of time to just sort of motivate why we're doing this particular work. So we really have sort of three motivations for developing West Wharf, and one is so that we can really study forecasts of extreme weather, and particularly atmospheric rivers, in a setting that we control. So we control end-to-end production of this numerical weather prediction system. That's really the only way that we do that at our center currently, and that means that we can do things like study how the physical processes are simulated within the model. So that's one thing that we find very important. We also believe that West Wharf is going to allow us to resolve the topographic forcing that's so important in California for producing precipitation, and will allow us to really not only tune the model, but tune the model in the right way, so to speak. So I'm going to speak to that a little bit later. There was one of our previous speakers mentioned that in some cases, we know that some of our models, even though they may have the right forcing or they may know what the global weather is doing, they might not get the right answer at the smaller scale where we really care about it. And that's one thing that we've really put our focus on for West Wharf in our early development stages. Some of this material is going to be a little bit of repeat. So this slide gives you an example of where we make our West Wharf predictions. The picture in the middle is a picture of the domain. So we have we're using a two-domain setup, one 9-kilometer domain that covers a large portion of the Northeast Pacific. You can see Hawaii just peeking at you down in the very lower left corner of that figure. That's run at a fairly high resolution, already at one of those 9 hydrostatic resolutions that Tim mentioned before. And then we have a nested domain that's run at 3-kilometer resolution. So the 3-kilometer resolution domain is really what we expect to give us good results for precipitation and getting the right result given the right forcing over California. There's some other details there, like physics, parameterized physics models, and how many vertical levels we use and all that. That's sort of esoteric, maybe not for this audience exactly. But I would like to point out that we're really trying to tailor to our specific region and our phenomena, and that we've really taken care to construct West Dwarf so that we minimize the error that comes at our large scale, and particularly through the boundary conditions from the global model that's forcing it, while maintaining an accurate relationship between those large scales that might partially come from that larger global model and the small scale predictions, particularly precipitation. I also want to talk a little bit about how we run on our supercomputer, and really that's through a partnership, a really unique partnership that we have through San Diego Supercomputing Center. So Scripps, as many of you know, is located near the campus of University of California, San Diego. We're sort of a subcampus. We get to be right by the beach. They have to stay up on the hill where, you know, some days there's actually more or less a 10-degree difference between our campus and theirs. But on upper campus, San Diego Supercomputing Center has a really nice facility. It's really a world-class high-performance computing research center. Example of the outside of the building and one of their servers there. These are sort of just eye candy pictures. But they're really invested in making sure that our model and our modeling effort at CW3E does well. So some of the ways I'd like to bring that home for you is that we're really, through our partnership with San Diego Supercomputing Center, we've really developed a truly interdisciplinary team. So for example, I have a background in meteorology, but we have oceanographers that are working with us as well that are more more focused on some of the physical interactions between the ocean and the atmosphere in our model, that are more focused on data assimilation. And we have computer scientists through our partnership at San Diego Supercomputing Center as well. We have some people that are experts in, for example, aerosols and cloud microphysics. And we're all working together to sort of bring an integrated approach to our model development. And not only do we have an integrated approach in terms of our science backgrounds, but we're also integrating our research and operational phases of our model. So there's a chart down in the lower middle of this slide that sort of goes over what our overarching model work plan is. We actually call it the Modeling and Cyber Infrastructure Plan at CW3E. And there are two phases to that. So one of those phases is that during the winter time, when most of the weather that we really care about for driving the hydrology in California is happening, or at least the input phase of the hydrology in California, we're producing real-time forecasts or near real-time forecasts. So you see that as one of the phases there. We're also, during the rest of the year, doing a lot of work to update our model. So I'll go through a little bit about the early history of West Dwarf here in a minute, but basically what we've done so far is we've had two seasons where we've been producing real-time forecasts, December through March, and then during the rest of the year we're looking at that and we're validating those forecasts with observations that are really specific to either the Pacific Ocean or California or the precipitation in California. And then we're making improvements. So every year we're coming out with a new version of our code that will be running real time, and we'll be doing that again here this December. I'd like to mention briefly that the San Diego Supercomputing Center director is a big part of this effort. You can see him in the picture on the lower right of this slide. So you see Marty Ralph, who you recognize from the room here, and in the middle of the picture, Mike Norman, who's also a professor of physics at UCSD, has actually really taken an interest in our effort, and some of our results and our ability to produce real-time forecasts would not be possible without Mike's help. So I'd like to just, even though he's not in the room, give him a big thank you for that. So like I mentioned, over the last couple winters, we've been able to produce our first real-time runs of West Dwarf. Here's another example of just a pretty picture that West Dwarf can create. This is a different field called integrated water vapor. And then there are some wind vectors on top of that, but it looks like those didn't show up well enough on the screen. So the pretty colors are the integrated water vapor, and that's another good way to identify where an atmospheric river is, although it doesn't really tell you much about the strength of the atmospheric river per se. We've also used, like I said, we've used a lot of observations to validate our model. And over the past couple of winters, while we've been running real time, we've also used our model forecast to motivate where some of those observations are being taken. So we've actually guided some field campaigns called Cal Water and the El Nino Rapid Response Program. We're also currently involved in an effort to develop an ensemble-based data assimilation capability with West Wharf. So we're going to be taking some of these, especially the airborne drop sonde observations that were part of those two campaigns, and trying to use those to create a new set of initial conditions and boundary conditions, which are very important for generating a probabilistic forecast in some of the ways that the previous two speakers have described to you. This is another slide that talks a little bit about our real-time forecasting capabilities. I'm going to skip through this because I've said most of it already, but I'll just note that there's some statistics or some numbers on exactly what we did in the last cool season, December 2015 through the end of March of this year. And it gives you a little bit more information about some of the field campaigns that we assisted with in this particular mode. So that's a little bit about what we've been doing with West Wharf. I wanted to quickly get into a scientific result that will be published hopefully submitted within the next month. One of the things is Marty has to give me his thoughts on those particular results. So really what I hope that you get from this particular slide, which may take a few minutes here, is how we're actually tailoring West Wharf to California precipitation. And we're really taking this concept of getting the right answer for the right reasons. So I'd like to use this first chart that's here to motivate that. And this actually comes from a result from a few years ago by Marty when he was still, I guess this is around the time that he was transitioning to Scripps. But Marty and his old group at NOAA noticed that you can really, if you take the storm-integrated rain that falls in at a place along the California coast, and you relate that to the storm-integrated quantity called terrain-normal vapor flux. So the terrain-normal vapor flux here is on the x-axis of this particular chart, and total precipitation is on the y. There's nearly a linear relationship that falls out. And the way that you can think of that is, the terrain normal vapor flux is your forcing that's provided from the large scale meteorology to a watershed. And so in this particular case, it's a very small watershed, and it's a very orographically productive watershed. But what we notice is through 10 years of observations at this particular watershed, the forcing, again, that's on the x-axis, and we'll call that sometimes the predictor in this framework, has some skill in actually determining what the predictand or the storm total precipitation from that watershed is. So again, I'll refer to the x-axis sometimes as the predictor or the forcing, and the y-axis here as the predictand or the watershed response. So what we did with West Wharf is we actually took this concept and we wanted to see, do numerical weather prediction models, and West Wharf is included in that, preserve this relationship more or less. So what I'm going to show you here in a minute is a number of cases in which we took the storm total predictor or the storm total forcing on the watershed, and we related it to the storm total response in the watershed using this same phase space that you see displayed here. So again, now we just removed the linear trend line there. This is our background. So this is all of our historical knowledge about where the phase space is occupied with atmospheric river storms in this particular watershed. And now I'm going to start overlaying real cases. So we'll start to see real storms here. The first one actually was from December of 2014, the first one that I'm going to show you. And you can see a depiction of the atmospheric river as it was in the satellite-based integrated water vapor framework, and then I believe that's 24-hour precipitation from Rob's shop down there on the bottom. And then if you'll notice, one of those black dots on the left panel has now been circled in orange. So that's our point in the phase space for this particular storm. Now, if we take a look at West Wharf and our operational GFS model, we'll notice that in this particular case, West Wharf gets an answer that's a little bit closer to the phase space, to the point in phase space that was observed. So you see West Wharf is in the, I like to call them cheese wheels for this particular symbol, and GFS is in the asterisks. I'll step through a few more of these in the same way, and we'll see this next storm, which is from January 17th, just making sure that the display is keeping up with me here. You'll see again that where the atmospheric river is, where the precip was for that particular storm, and then there's a circle around the particular dot in our history of where that storm lied in the phase space for atmospheric rivers for this watershed. And again, in this case, it's not as striking, but West Wharf does better in terms of picking out where this storm was in the predicted phase space. Going forward in time again, we have another storm from 2016 now. Again, AR on top, over on the right-hand side, precipitation that resulted on bottom. This was something that sort of just grazed Northern California. Observed phase space, and now predicted phase space. Again, our model is, primarily because of its high resolution and the physics that we picked out, we believe is doing better in capturing the phase space. I think this is either the last example. Yes, this is the last example of that. Again, we have, just making sure, the West Wharf doing a better job of picking out exactly where we are in the phase space. And if we take all of the storms that we've looked at, so this one's just a simplified plot. I've only got those five storms on there, but we've done it for a few more at this point. We can get an idea of how well, generally, in a normalized distance component within this phase space, the West Wharf model does compared to the GFS model. And that's what's now in the inset table in the top of the figure. So you can see that West Wharf, in general, predicts a distance within the phase space that's around two times the observational variance within that phase space for all of these storms. But the coarser resolution models actually do much worse if we just look at this generalized two-dimensional distance. I have that over there on the left-hand side for only 72-hour lead times, but there's a table here summarizing how that shakes out for several different lead times. So we've looked at this for a lot of lead times going from 24 hours or one day all the way out to 8 days. And you'll see there that inside of 72 hours, West Wharf actually gives you an answer that's within the observed variance within this phase space. But over lead times, as most models do, that skill, more this sort of special indicator of skill, erodes. And eventually, we don't get any value over the coarse resolution model by the time we get out to 7 days. By the way, this is just sort of a general look at where we are in both predictor and predict-and space, but we've also tried to answer the question, if we just isolate what the predictor is, we ask the question, does the model get the predictor right, or the x-axis component of this phase space right? Given that, which one does better in forecasting the response? We get a similar answer, in that when West Wharf gets the right terrain normal upslope vapor flux, it predicts a better response in terms of precipitation in the watershed. And again, we think that's because we're really tailoring it. We're hitting this particular region for these particular storms. Again, going back to the right answer for the right reasons terminology. So at this point, about halfway through the presentation, I'm going to take you back to meteorology class. Or for some of you, I'm sure this will be the first time maybe that you've been in meteorology classroom, and talk to you about a specific weather phenomenon that we're investigating at CW3. So we call these, and not just us, we've got other collaborators and other peers in the literature that are calling these mesoscale frontal waves. So I want to really first talk to you about what a mesoscale frontal wave is, and then talk to you about why they might be important for determining the outcome in terms of precipitation and also potentially flooding from an atmospheric river. Oh, okay, I have 5 minutes. So a mesoscale frontal wave is actually a feature that develops along an existing atmospheric river. And in this case, you see an example of an existing atmospheric river that makes landfall near the Oregon coast in December of 2014. Now, the left-hand plot is actually the integrated vapor transport view of that atmospheric river with some other special fields laid on top of it. So the other fields there are sea level pressure, and that allows you to see where the low pressure and high pressure is for this particular storm. So most atmospheric rivers have this configuration where they exist between a low pressure system and a high pressure system. On the right, we have a little bit more advanced fields for meteorology. One of them is showing at 700 hectopascals, so further up in the atmosphere, where that low pressure wave is. So you see it's actually right above where it is at the surface. And then where another meteorological field called frontogenesis is taking place. So that's a little bit like, what is the atmospheric flow doing to make temperature gradients stronger or weaker? And where they're in green or in blue on these figures, it's making it stronger. So initially in this particular storm, we have an atmospheric river, we have a low pressure system, and we have a little bit of frontogenesis out in front of the low pressure system. Now as we go forward in time, we'll notice that the atmospheric river starts bending as another low pressure trough fills in near the southwest extent of this AR. And you'll notice there's a little bit of a bulge in the lower part of the AR. That's what we call a cusp associated with these mesoscale frontal waves. And as we go forward even further in time, now we see over in the right-hand side, we've got some secondary, what we call secondary frontogenesis, going on along the current atmospheric river. So we've got this new, not quite fully developed, low-pressure center spinning up along the atmospheric river after the old low-pressure center is moving away, and we've got additional frontogenesis. I'll move forward a couple more frames here. At the end, near the end of this cycle, we have a new low-pressure system spun up totally that's now basically strengthened and realigned our atmospheric river in new orientation and potentially in a slightly different location, and that's associated with this much stronger frontogenesis that's going on aloft. So basically, you can think of this process as we have an atmospheric river, we had a low-pressure system that was responsible for that atmospheric river, and as we go forward in time, a new low-pressure center rapidly spins up along the atmospheric river and changes the characteristics of the atmospheric river. So I'll skip through the rest of these as I'm getting a little bit out of time. And we know that these can actually modulate atmospheric river impact in a couple ways. So one of the ways is from the results of a study from MARTI in 2011. We have here some satellite imagery that shows you where the AR is in four different times, and you'll see a couple of those. There's a frontal wave indicated by its cusp in the satellite imagery. At the final time, we have a new atmospheric river that's become more southwesterly oriented. And Marty and his colleagues actually did a study based on this case of how long atmospheric river conditions hung around at various places along the West Coast. And because of the cusp of the mesoscale frontal wave, which you can sort of see as you go from the black line to the red line to the green line to the purple, as that frontal wave cusp propagated northeast and the atmospheric river at the same time propagated southwest, some areas near the mouth of the Columbia River actually experienced atmospheric river conditions for more than 28 hours, whereas the rest of the West Coast, this was just a sort of a rapid event that came and went and did not last that long. We also know that we can see the signatures of these events in some of our hydrologic predictions. So we've just used an example of a hydrograph or several hydrograph forecasts from Rob's shop from one of these events that occurred in 2014, December of 2014. And we see if we look at on the left, the 5-day to 1-day integrated precipitation totals that were, or 5-day lead time and 24-hour precipitation amount, we can see that a lot of the area, the region of Northern California, had an over-forecast in precipitation that actually was more, I guess, the over-forecast was greater as we got closer and closer to the event. On the other hand, if we take a look at the hydrograph over on the right-hand side, we see that as we go, the event was on December 11th. I'm not sure if that's particularly clear on here, but as we go from the hydrograph forecast on December 8th to December 10th, we had an increasingly high-intensity peak in that hydrograph that eventually, one day before the event actually happened, predicted a fairly significant flood at Guerneville on the Russian River. The real event actually turned out to be much less significant, or it's still near flood stage, but not as significantly over. And so with this particular event, we'll note that what happened during this time from December 8th to December 10th is that this mesoscale frontal wave developed along an existing atmospheric river that was in the forecast previously, but we didn't know about it until about 24 hours beforehand. So these are actually very challenging. What some of the work that we're doing to sort of address these challenges and forecasts are looking at these in a climatological sense. So we've developed a case list at CW3E for mesoscale frontal waves that have occurred that have impacted the Russian River watershed and the northern coastal mountain ranges of California. Going all the way back, in this slide, it's going back to 2009, but we've recently extended that back to 2006. And what we're doing is we're taking a look at some of the dynamic characteristics associated with the mesoscale frontal waves. Now, since I'm running out of time, I won't go through much detail on that, but I will just point out that we do see some pretty large differences in our frontal wave cases versus our non-frontal wave cases. And so the frontal wave cases here are on the top, and the non-frontal wave cases are on the bottom. For some of you, if there are any meteorology geeks in the audience, I'll just put some of these up so you can take a look at them. But we do see some pretty significant differences in what the Pacific upper tropospheric jet is doing during these cases, in the orientation of our atmospheric rivers, in the location and strengths of subtropical highs over the northeastern Pacific, and in what the Gulf of Alaska low pressure system is doing over the course of these events. And we believe that some of these, by identifying them and then figuring out how models are actually handling these particular aspects of the large scale dynamics, could yield keys to extending predictability of this type of event. So with that, I'll just put up my summary slide and I'll open the floor for questions.
What proportion of the atmospheric rivers that are the largest have secondary frontal waves, or are they characteristic of just normal atmospheric rivers, or are they more or less common with the largest, most extreme ones?
I think that's a pretty good question. I don't know that we have an answer for how frequency of mesoscale frontal wave is modulated by atmospheric river strength yet. But we have noticed that when we're looking, and again, we're just looking for a specific region on the West Coast so far, about one in every 3 to 4 experiences this secondary frontal wave development. Again, we think it's really, really governed by what's going on in the large-scale dynamic environment. And those large-scale dynamic environments, it turns out, are probably favorable for at least moderate strength atmospheric rivers is what we think right now.
No more questions?
So as a fellow meteorologist in the room, I want to put you on the spot a little bit. So it doesn't surprise me that you've got more skill on these localized events than a global model, mm-hmm. And I think it's an important benchmark. But have you guys looked at comparisons to some of the other regional modeling systems out there in terms of skill?
Yeah, we did. So we looked at, in the same way, we looked at the North American model, and we looked at sort of our own red team version of the model, where we relaxed the outer domain so that we knew we were getting worse forcing information, essentially. And we're still doing better than in both of those. And it turns out that we're not really sure why at this point, but the North American model doesn't do particularly well for that particular region. This doesn't mean that it doesn't do better elsewhere, but for where we were looking at.
Anyone else? Did you want to go over to your, you got a few minutes, you want to go over your summary slide?
Oh, sure, yeah. So anyway, some of the take-home points, I guess, are that currently CW3E is really focusing a lot of research on atmospheric rivers, and Marty can speak to this as they apply to the FIRO concept, which he'll talk about later. But I want to leave the audience with the sense that that's because they're very important to both flooding and water supply in California. So we're really focusing on a type of meteorological phenomena because we believe that these have the greatest impact to users that are largely represented in rooms like this. And our West Wharf modeling system, where I hit sort of some of the three main bullet points expressed in different language earlier, but we're using this as a test bed or as a vehicle to develop new forecast methodologies, specifically methodologies that leverage unique data that we think is underserved at some of the other numerical weather prediction shops around the country. And I brought up a point in which we were able to demonstrate good forecast skill. We've looked at our ability to demonstrate good forecast skill in a more traditional sense through things like equitable threat scores as well, and we're doing very competitively there as well. And then again, we're really focusing on whether or not we get the correct physical relationships in our model as well. And there's a reason for that, which is that we're interested not only in producing very good forecasts, but also understanding some of the yet to be really well described physics that govern the atmosphere and govern extreme precipitation in California. Our mesoscale frontal wave research is a new frontier, and we're just really starting to take a long-term view of mesoscale frontal waves, but we hope that through both targeted study, I didn't have a chance to go through with you some of the results we have from actually flying aircraft into mesoscale frontal wave systems, but that's another aspect of research that we're going through. And this longer term or climatological analysis of mesoscale frontal waves, we hope that that leads to our ability to extend useful predictions when we have an atmospheric river within a mesoscale frontal wave.
Thank you.